Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us online as commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel. I'm Dennis Wu, past chair of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, a member of the Board of Directors of the Committee 100, and your chair of today's program. This program is co-organized by the Committee 100. Established in 1990 as a nonprofit organization, the Committee of 100 has a rich legacy of harnessing the power of its distinguished membership to address significant complex issues pertaining to Americans of Chinese descent in U.S.-China relations. Now on to today's program. Today we'll discuss China and its relationship with the U.S. with Howard French, former New York Times Asia correspondent, and author of the new book, Everything Under the Heavens, How the Past Helps Shape China's Push for Global Power. And Dr. George Koo, regular contributor to the online Asia Times, a member of the Committee 100, and chairman of the Burlingame Foundation. Our moderator today will be George Lewinsky, former foreign editor of Marketplace. Let me say a bit about our distinguished speakers. Howard French was a French-English translator in the Ivory Coast in the early 1980s and taught English literature for several years at the University of Abidjan. His career in journalism begins as a freelance reporter for the Washington Post and other publications in West Africa. In 1986, he joined the New York Times as a metropolitan reporter, and then from 1990 to 2008, reported overseas as bureau chief for Central America and the Caribbean, West and Central Africa, Japan, and China. His coverage was twice nominated for the Pulitzer Prize, and he was twice the recipient of an Overseas Press Club Award. Mr. French was also a weekly columnist on global affairs for the International Herald Tribune. He received his BA in political science from the University of Massachusetts and holds an honorary doctorate from the University of Maryland. Dr. George Koo was born in China and has been advising and assisting American companies in developing their business interests in China since 1978. He retired from Deloitte, and since 2000, he has served on the board of New America Media, the first and largest collaboration of ethnic news organizations. Dr. Koo is a regular contributor to online Asia Times and to China-U.S. Focus. And he maintains a personal blog with an interest in presenting a Chinese-American perspective on the U.S.-China bilateral relationship. George Koo holds bachelor's and master's of science degrees from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, an MBA from Santa Clara University, and a doctorate from Stevens Institute of Technology. Moderating today's discussion will be George Lewinsky, former foreign editor of Marketplace Radio. George Lewinsky is well regarded for his coverage of international business and economic issues on U.S. public radio. Much of his reporting on Marketplace involved the growing relationship between the U.S. and China, particularly China, U.S. and Asia, and particularly China. Mr. Lewinsky also served as a lecturer at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism and as foreign editor and producer for the Canadian Broadcasting Company's Radio and Television News Division. He received his BA in History from McGill University. Please welcome Howard French, George Koo, and George Lewinsky.
Thank you very much, and thank you to all of you for coming on a not pleasant night. And I hope it doesn't rain too much when we're leaving this place. Mr. French, in the acknowledgments to the book, Everything Under the Heavens, you write that the idea for it came when you were a correspondent in Tokyo in the 1990s, and you were struck by the similarities between the three countries in Northwest Asia, Japan, China, and Korea, and yet you were kind of puzzled by how they seemed trapped in a kind of loop of recrimination and distrust compared to, let's say, the three major powers in Europe, France, Germany, and the UK, which seem to have sort of gotten over the centuries of war that they had. Can you explain that?
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to be before such a big audience here in San Francisco, to be back to San Francisco, to see some relatives and some old friends, and to be on the stage with you both tonight. So the starting interrogation was this, that if you look at the principal countries of Northwestern Europe and the principal countries of Northeast Asia, what you find is a common basis in a lot of really important things: writing systems, religion, philosophy, legal ideas, etc., that go back a very long ways. You found in both of these areas, at opposite ends of the Eurasian landmass, interminable war between the peoples of these three societies that I've selected. And then something striking happens in the mid-19th century after one of the worst wars ever, perhaps the worst war ever. The Northwestern Europeans find a compact to overcome their past divisiveness and killing and form a greater union. And the Northeast Asians were not able to do that. And so I was sitting in Japan, not having yet arrived in China as a correspondent, but traveling to the Korean Peninsula quite a lot as part of my reporting responsibilities, and at that point traveling to China a bit, but not extensively yet, and not speaking Chinese yet, and wondering why that is. And so that was the starting interrogation. It turns out to be a very different book, and the reason it turns out to be a very different book, that's not the question at the heart of this book. The reason it turns out to be, one of the reasons it turns out to be a very different book is because once I begin to get to know China a few years after I left Japan, I came to understand the element of disproportion that exists in Northeast Asia that does not exist in Northwestern Europe came sort of to full realization in my mind. China is this gigantic country. That's not a reproach of China, but it's an immutable fact, right? China is this gigantic society that is completely out of proportion with surrounding societies. China has the longest among them, the longest record of continuous government and civilization. These other societies have borrowed much more heavily from China than you could make the case China has borrowed from them, and so this is not a mirror of Western Europe at all. And so this put me on quite a different path in the end.
Right. I guess the major difference is, in addition to its huge size and longer history, China has seen itself traditionally as sort of the center of the world. It rules, or the emperor rules everything under heaven, as the title of your book. What was its relationship with people on the periphery?
Well, because of China's hugely disproportionate size, this viewpoint or view of itself emerges that we are indeed the center, and that everyone else is inescapably inferior to us or of secondary status to us. And that the natural or ideal state of things is that they should recognize this, and that we should treat them in an enlightened and benevolent way, and that this will form the basis of stability and harmony in the region. That everybody knows we're the greatest, we're the most important, and we're showering our cultural goods on them, and therefore, in return, they behave in obeisant and deferential ways. And this is, to be very, very simple about it, the sort of essence of an idealized Pax Sinica throughout Asian history.
And that Pax Sinica was generally a peaceful one, in the sense that, unlike Western Europe, where you had constant conflict, very often for long periods of history, the peoples on the periphery of China accepted the benefits of Chinese civilization, the benevolence of the emperor?
So, I think it's a bit more complicated than that. First of all, China got to be as big as it is. The thing we recognize in any common map as China is a fairly recent thing in the scheme of things. China starts out a very long time ago as something called Zhongyuan, which is essentially parts of four present-day provinces in central China near the Yellow River. And China gets to be the big China that we see on the map today through a very gradual process of conquest, of assimilation, of migration, and various other things that gradually allow it to expand. And it's not one constant, steady expansion, by the way. There are setbacks. It expands, it contracts, it expands, it contracts. And then it gets locked into place, in effect, by the Westphalian world international system, whereby modern states recognize each other's borders and sovereignty. So China was, across the breadth of this long history, waging in what we would now think of as internal wars, but there was no such thing as China back then. There were empires. It was an empire. There were dynasties. And dynasties are dynamic things, right? And so China was waging war against various peoples and using other means, economic, cultural, etc., to try to assimilate other peoples. And that was the case as well with people on the periphery, outside of what we now recognize as China. So with the example of Vietnam, which I discussed at great length in my book, you know, there were very, very extensive and prolonged wars and occupations by China to try to get the Vietnamese to assimilate the same way that the Chinese were able to get what we're saying the Chinese, by the way. There was no such thing as the Chinese back then. It was the Qing Dynasty or the Yuan Dynasty or the Ming Dynasty or the Song Dynasty, et cetera, et cetera. But for simplicity's sake, we'll call that the Chinese. So there were these wars going back to the Tang Dynasty. Actually, the first Chinese-Vietnamese wars were in the Han Dynasty. But going back to the big wars.
And that's like in pre-Christ.
Correct. In the Tang Dynasty, to try to get Vietnam to sort of fold into what we now recognize as China. And China invested huge means, including huge military means, including prolonged and very stringent occupation, but in the end, that project didn't, as we know from looking at the map, Vietnam continued to evolve in another direction and not become part of China.
And then something rather terrible happened to China and to its sense of itself. The Europeans ran into China, and for 100 years at least, China was carved up and lost a great deal of prestige and territory. How was that event or that series of events looked at in China?
So the what you're talking about is something commonly referred to in China as the century of humiliation, which is basically from the middle of the 19th century to the middle of the 20th century, when European powers, and in the tail end of this century, also the United States, became involved in a series of imperialist quests around the world. And I think it's easily forgotten by non-specialists the extensiveness of this. So Europe basically conquered the entire world and colonized essentially the entire world. The countries that were not colonized, off the top of my head, I can think of Japan, I can think of the other ones require asterisks. So Thailand, you could say Thailand wasn't fully colonized. There was an arrangement between the French and the British that allowed Thailand to become to remain nominally independent. And then China was semi-colonized. It was carved up, as you said, and protectorates of various kinds were established by European powers in China. And this came at a great loss to Chinese wealth, to Chinese momentum in terms of economic development. China was already, many historians believe, beginning to successfully industrialize when the Europeans showed up in this invasion mode, and this derailed that and cost China in many other ways. And so this is your question is, how is this thought of in China? It's used in recent times, it's been used as a kind of motif in nationalist education to get Chinese, young Chinese people in China to kind of adhere to an idea of national rejuvenation or resuscitation. And this was given a slogan quite explicitly with the arrival in power of the present president, Xi Jinping, in late 2012, I think, when in his first days in office he proclaimed the watchword, in effect, of his rule was that the phrase the China Dream, and the longer version of this is the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. And all of that means is what that all means is that Chinese people should put their shoulders to the wheel and all contribute to this national reconstruction.
And does it mean that China wants to, that Xi Jinping wants China to regain its place at least as the center of Asia?
So there's not a whole lot of official discourse. There's not a whole lot of speech that you can point your finger at which says, from any official source in China, that says we want to be the preeminent power in Asia, or that we want to be the preeminent power in the world, far less, right? You have to understand these things at a kind of more diffuse level of conversation. It's my reading. The reading in my book, one of my main conclusions is, and I don't take this as an unusual thing, I think if you're a country of China's size, if you're a country of China's recent economic success, if you're a country of China's long and very rich history of success and of development and of innovation and of technology and of science and of achievement of all different kinds, you put those things together, it is normal, in a way of speaking, for China to want to be preeminent, both in its region and, you could even say, in the world. There's nothing surprising about either one of those things. It is my deduction, my conclusion in the book, that China does indeed wish to be preeminent in the Western Pacific or in East Asia, and that it may be, and I don't come down hard and fast on this, but it may be that China would like also to be preeminent in the world at some time.
George Ku, I think that as a Chinese American, you would be proud of China's rise, its economic strength, the changes that have gone on in the country since, say, 1945. Do you think that Mr. French, Professor French, is right in saying that China wants to be a hegemon in Asia?
Well, I think my answer would be a qualified yes and no, but I have to compliment Professor French for really a very nicely put together book on the history of China and the surrounding countries. And for that in itself, I would highly recommend you all buying a copy, and that will also make Professor French very happy to come out tonight. But I do want to take an opportunity to contrast. Well, let me go back. During the early Clinton administration, I was involved with the Committee on 100 in preparing a white paper. And the white paper was seeking common grounds while recognizing differences, respecting differences. My concern is more and more today, we are emphasizing the differences and picking it like a scab and ignoring the common grounds. And that's leading the two countries seems in more and more antagonistic position. Now, going back to your question, I think Xi Jinping has been expressing, since Obama became president, continued to express that China is not looking to compete as a hegemon and replace the United States in any way whatsoever, but China would like to be respected as a peer. And they go about things very differently from the United States. They work within the United Nations. They don't dictate rules on how each country should be governed. Their very recent One Belt, One Road initiative, for example, is sending out the message that we want to work with any country who is interested in our help in the infrastructure building. And we can go into some example. I think Djibouti in Africa is one that Professor French may have referred to before as well. But, you know, hopefully by the end of tonight's discussion, the point I want to make is that it's going to be in our national interest, the United States and China, the people, to figure out a way to get along, not figuring out a way how to become adversaries and enemies. And that's where I think we should be heading.
All right. Recently, Professor French, there have been a series of disputes, confrontations between China and its neighbors. Let's talk about Japan, the island issue in the East China Sea. Is China showing that its peaceful rise, that it really has no claims, or is this camouflage, in your opinion, to some extent?
I'm not sure I understand the question, the phrase in the question, China has no claims. China has long had a claim in the East China Sea, and the problem is a difference of claims. That Japan has occupancy of a group of small islands, which it calls the Senkaku, and China calls the Diaoyudao. They have different legal arguments about why these rightfully belong to one versus the other. Japan has the very considerable advantage of a record of continuous control of those islands that dates back over a century, interrupted only briefly by the American occupation of Japan. And the secondary advantage of recent American statements that grew out of a kind of testing by China of Japan's will to sustain its control of those islands. A series of statements by American leaders, beginning with Hillary Clinton, that the United States, although it takes no position about the legality of one country's position about ownership of the islands, it recognizes Japan's administrative control of the islands and considers that fact to be sufficient for those islands to be covered by the mutual defense treaty between the United States and Japan. And so that's where the situation is now. China says, this was always ours, and you came in and you usurped us and took advantage of us at the end of the Sino-Japanese War in a really kind of devious way. And Japan says, no, we didn't do that at all. We declared this stuff our property, and you didn't protest it at the time back in 1895, and we've had it ever since. And, you know, that's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. So, that's I'm being very crudely simplistic, right. But those are the basic positions of the two sides.
Is this a little test for both countries? The islands are this little test for both countries about who's going to blink first, or is it Japan saying that we could rival you in Asia, and the Chinese resisting that?
It's a test. It's a multi-sided test. China didn't make much noise about this until relatively recently. It began to become an irritant really substantially kind of late in the Hu Jintao era. Although the issue has always been there. But under the Deng Xiaoping period and for most of the Jiang Zemin period, the attitude was basically, we have bigger fish to fry, the Chinese attitude.
Right,
Japan's investing a lot in China. We're getting a lot of technological stuff from Japan. This relationship is, let's not rock the boat too much. Mm-hmm. And more recently, China has, because of its immense success in economic development, it has been able to field a very robust Coast Guard and also a very robust Navy and various other sort of auxiliary forces, like the maritime, there's a kind of official maritime fisheries mm-hmm. administration. You used the verb test. It has used these various components of its maritime forces to probe and to test around the Senkaku Diaoyu to see what Japan will do.
To what end?
Well, so the third piece, I said this is a multi-dimensional game going on here. One piece of this is for China to kind of test Japan's determination, to signal to Japan that this game is only beginning and you may have a bigger navy or you may even be more capable than us in maritime terms right now, but the writing is on the wall. Pretty soon or in the foreseeable future, we will be more powerful than you, and that will never reverse again. So we're going to probe and probe and probe and test and see. Maybe they'll come to their senses and say it's better we cut a deal with them. The other sort of testing, though, is to see just how serious, from the Chinese perspective, to see just how serious the United States' commitment to the Japanese is. And the Japanese are just as worried about that, too. So everybody's looking at everybody else, you know, and saying, how serious are they? Mm-hmm. And trying to figure out, you know, when is it time to actually come to terms?
I think there's nothing to argue in the give and take that Professor French just described, but there are certain facts that we need to keep in mind in this particular controversy. At the end of World War II, the terms of the unconditional surrender that Japan signed on to was to give up all rights and ownership of all the islands, offshore islands that they acquired from 1894-95 on. And the only difference between the Diaoyu Senkaku Island versus the islands that the Koreans held onto and the islands that the Russians held onto was that at the end of World War II, the Russians and the Koreans occupied those islands. The Chinese were not able to occupy the Diaoyu Senkaku because the Americans took control of it. And when the Americans turned it over in 1971, they turned it over to Japan, and both China and Taiwan vigorously protested. It was a big movement in the United States at that time, complaining about the unfairness of this particular transaction, if you will.
Just to be so everyone knows, we are talking about islands that are, as far as I know, uninhabited right
That's
now.
Right. Uninhabitable.
And probably, uninhabitable as well. They are rocks that have very little value of any kind.
I would say it's fair to say that for Japan's point of view and for the Chinese point of view, there's a lot of emotion tied to the ownership of those islands as opposed to the alleged fishing rights or oil or whatever. But more recent history, what really kick-started the whole controversy again was when Ishihara, the governor of Tokyo, decided to, quote-unquote, purchase those islands from private ownership, and the Japanese government did not want the governor Ishihara to do that. So then they proceeded to say, "Oh, we better nationalize the ownership."
A clumsy move.
It didn't, and I would say that the response from Beijing was probably equally clumsy. But it got to be much bigger and bigger, and hasn't died down in any way whatsoever.
One of the points you make in the book, Professor French, specifically about Japan, is that sometimes the Chinese government kind of gets itself in a box where it really can't do anything except push forward, because public opinion in China is so inflamed that they feel they can't do. They would lose too much. They would lose face. They would and perhaps even power if they gave up these tiny uninhabitable pieces of rock.
Right.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So face is a really interesting concept, and we don't have time to do it justice right here, but face can be understood as kind of rules of decorum that are attributed, I think, with unnecessary or undue specificity to China, where you're not supposed to embarrass your host, or, you know, you're supposed to, you know, there are certain niceties that you just don't transgress.
Well, Japan, too, has this.
No, my point is I think that much of that is universal, and that this is wrongly ascribed to being some kind of, excuse me for the phrase, I'm saying this mockingly, a kind of oriental thing, right? I think the elements of face are actually, the rudiments of face are basically universal. But once you start down discussion of face, and China, by the way, in fact, in its own diplomatic conversation sometimes, you know, gets into matters of face, it's also a kind of a threat, which is, look, if you make us lose face, who knows what will happen? And that's where we are with this precise question. So China has, since the 1990s, so in 1989 you had the Tiananmen Square events, and subsequently, under Jiang Zemin, you had the introduction of what was called the Nationalist Education Movement or campaign, where the textbooks were totally revised, and, you know, love of country and a stirred up kind of emotion driven nationalist vision gets introduced into Chinese education, and not too long afterwards, the media sort of begins to feed into this. So it's not just a school textbook thing, but it becomes a broader kind of phenomenon, right? The government did those things. The state did those things. We say the government, the Communist Party, which rules China, decided those things and implemented them through the government. But now we're in this situation of kind of weaponized face where basically you say, well, look, if you do anything to upset those people, anything, you know, really bad things could happen. That could be both true and ridiculous, right? And so that's where we are.
But similarly, you know, Japan has also revised textbooks and sure. had you know, has stirred up, particularly the, you know, it seems to me the current administration, as the Abe administration, has stirred up emotions as well.
Sure. So I don't, you know, I don't think anyone who reads my book should come away, or hopefully will come away, with the idea that I have choose good guys and bad guys.
You point out in the book that you know the Japanese have their own issues of face about the islands and also about China generally.
Sure. My point, though, in response to your question about the Japanese textbooks, is a real difference in terms of the way Japan and China handles these sorts of questions is, yes, if it is true that emotion serves as an important element in nationalism everywhere and that emotionalism is manipulated by people in government, we're having it. Right before I came here, I watched a Trump rally in Kentucky where he was whipping up nationalism about immigration and various other things. So nationalism in government is a real phenomenon around the world in various places. The difference between China and Japan in this regard is that Japan is a much more open society in terms of the movement of information and the possibility of exposure to very varying currents of information than China is. And that China, you know, very willfully and with great skill censors information and is able to control the conversation more. And so that's all I would add.
I have friends from Japan about my age, which meant that they were, not quite teenagers going the World War II years. And their idea of what happened in World War II is so different from my perception. They didn't understand, they didn't think that the Japanese committed atrocities all across Asia. They think these, because they went through the educational system in Japan, they see themselves as victims of World War II. Very few of them are sufficiently in. And when a very good friend of mine, a colleague, we were at SRI together, and when we have this kind of discussion, we end up saying, well, let's not talk about it anymore because we're just not getting anywhere. You know? And it's truly amazing to me that there's so many people in Japan that sees themselves as victims of World War II?
Well, so
yeah, I mean, I'll use a question from the audience to follow up on this. Is there a peaceful diplomatic solution to this island issue between Japan and China, or and could it, the questioner asks, be used about Taiwan as well?
Who are you asking?
You.
Okay. So, I mean, it would be unfortunate to spend too much of the limited time on these islands. There's so much ground to cover. But I would say that, for me, the most promising avenue for all of Asia for the resolution of matters like this are already established legal venues, that there are courts that have been constituted for the purpose of settling maritime and territorial disputes, and that this, that all of the powers of Asia subscribing to the relevance and capacity of these sorts of courts for the adjudication of disputes like this would be a good thing for all of Asia, and that Japan should take the first step and say to China, listen, let's go to court about this. And, you know, there are people who say Potsdam should decide this. There's people who say this or that should decide it. Let's go to a presumable neutral venue. And on the basis of international law and treaties of various kinds that we have both signed up to, let's see if we can work this out in a legal fashion. I think I don't think that's going to happen tomorrow, but I think that that is the best prospect for peace. The reason why I think it was worth getting into this discussion, both now and in my book, is because the Senkaku Diaoyu are the most sort of proximate potential tripwire for war in Northeast Asia between Japan and China. That an accident, literally an accident, an unintended event could start a war between, around these islands, could start a war between these two countries. And that would be a really terrible thing.
George, I don't see a comparable analogy between how China and Japan should handle the Diaoyu Senkaku situation versus Taiwan. Taiwan's situation has no comparability to that situation. The Taiwan is indeed going to be a problem that has to be resolved by the people of Taiwan and Beijing and China as well. And right now, the Taiwan economy is taking a rather severe hit because of the insistence of the current government to go it alone, and it's not getting any cooperation from China that way. And I one of the things that I think we need to keep in mind is that because China is becoming the second largest economy at this point, they have a lot of clout just from whether they are going to cooperate with you economically or not. And that takes into Japan and other countries as well. I have a story about how Japan and China in their happier days have a happier story. A former bureaucrat of the Ministry of Finance gave a talk actually in Berlin last year, and he talked about how after Fukushima, the hotels in Tokyo were vacancy was as high as 90%. But then the tourists from China started to come, and they doubled until in 2015 or so, there were 5 million tourists from China. And during the cherry blossom time, the hotels in Tokyo were overflowing. And the average spending was $3,000 per tourist, which is $15 billion of help to the Japanese economy. Then the speaker goes on to say, when I was at the Ministry of Finance, from 1989, for the 6 years, we negotiated and we provided soft loans to China, roughly $10 billion or more per year at a 0.5% interest. And those $10 million went to build airports, Beijing and Shanghai and Guangzhou, built railroads, built ports, built all the different infrastructures, telephone systems, and so on. And because of those 6 years of investment, China got wealthy, and when they got wealthy, they send the tourists to Japan. So what goes around comes around, and that's really a happy story that we need to think and keep in mind between China and the United States.
Professor French talked about Japan should take legal action. Japan and China should together take legal action to try to solve the dispute about the islands. The Philippines, moving 2,000 miles further south, China's claimed 90% of the South China Sea as its own, more or less. Philippines took it to court, and my reading of the court decision, International Court of Settlements at The Hague, was basically China's case was trashed. Mm-hmm. China does not seem to be willing to accept international arbitration.
So China said before Philippines even initiated that case that if you don't do this, it warned Philippines not to do it. And when Philippines went ahead and did it, it said, whatever, we're not going to present an argument. We're not going to be present as an official party to this dispute. Mm-hmm. And no matter what this tribunal decides, we're not going to feel bound. We will not be bound by its decisions. Since then, or while that was going on, China warned Vietnam, which made signs of sort of flirting with the notion of filing a sympathetic brief to the Philippines, or perhaps even introducing its own case, because it has claims in the South China Sea in contrast or in conflict with China's. China warned Vietnam not to do that, saying, look, you have all this trade and investment with us. It will be in peril if you infringe on our prerogatives. I think that, your question earlier was, how do you avoid war? How do you avoid conflict? And I think that law is a great fruit of civilization. And the most it's not a perfect check. It's not, it has not saved us from all wars in the past, obviously, right? But it is the best check we have on this old thing called might makes right. And might makes right is, you'll all know, a situation where the biggest, baddest guy in the playground says, that's my apple, or that's my girlfriend, or that's my whatever, right? And if you like it or you don't like it, it's mine. And that kind of behavior creates terrible dynamics, not just in terms of the immediate winners or losers, but it sets up, in fact, things that China claims not to like. So China says, why are there alliances in the Western Pacific or in East Asia? That alliances are a relic of Cold War thinking, that anybody to join into a security partnership with the United States is being in some way anti-China, et cetera, et cetera. Well, one simple reason why people come together in alliances in that part of the world is because they fear the disproportion that exists, and that China, as we have seen in through these threats, don't use the court, or I'm not going to respect the short court, that China may arrogate to itself the right as the biggest guy on the playground to do what it wants. Now, I want to say in conclusion, I don't mention this about China because I think China is unique in this regard. The United States has, one is perfectly right to object, been the biggest guy on the playground plenty of times. The United States has not itself ratified the law of the sea, which would be probably the most pertinent piece of law to help us adjudicate through an issue like the Senkaku Jiaoyu, et cetera. However, principled settlement for me always beats conflictual settlement.
George, you started out by mentioning this case is coming. What did you say? International Court of Justice?
Settlements.
Yeah. It's actually from the Permanent Court of Arbitration, which is not tied to the United Nations Law of the Seas. It has an office in The Hague, the same place where the International Court is, but it's only an office. There's no official ties, no linkage. And when you talk about an arbitration, usually it means both parties has to be involved. In this case, China was not involved. Philippines reluctantly was involved because Washington kind of pushed them along and said, we'll pay the bills and you go and take up the case. And then when the new president got elected in Philippines, he promptly changed his mind and said, forget the whole thing. So we need to put the proper perspective. And as Professor French pointed out, United States was trying to pick a fight, but they really didn't have a dog in the fight because they didn't even, they're not even a signatory to the UNCLOS.
But they do have a security treaty with the Philippines.
I'm not sure I said the United States was trying to pick a fight.
I
would also add that China and the Philippines, wherever their office is, whatever basis of the legal language that founded this tribunal, China and the Philippines are both signatories to it. And so the fact that China did not show up in court is something that can only be imputable to China. It's not because it was some weird office in some strange place. It's because China decided it didn't want to be bound by a legal ruling.
I'd like to move on, if I could, to talk about U.S.-China relations. We had, whether George Ku is right or not, that the United States pushed the Philippines into taking the case, or bringing the case. There's kind of little doubt that the United States is concerned about its allies in Asia. Security treaty with Japan, security treaty with the Philippines. And I'm wondering whether all this to-ing and fro-ing over islands is sort of a cover for the U.S. and China probing each other to see whether one will blink.
Sure. So, I mean, there's retired Chinese generals who have given interviews to the effect that, and some of them are quoted in my book, that control, domination of the South China Sea, and that word domination is used by them, is an essential step to China's emergence as a first-rank naval power. And other quotes saying, similarly, that domination of the South China Sea via the creation of artificial islands is an essential step for us, the Chinese, to be able to control, to overmatch the Americans in the Western Pacific. I take these men at their word, that that's what they really believe, that the Americans didn't make them say that, and that this represents a perspective somewhere meaningfully in China. Probably, maybe one might object this is just some contingent of retired military people who feel this way, but I suspect maybe it's more than that. I want to come back to something I said earlier, almost at the outset here. I think it is entirely normal that a country of China's size and geographic attributes and cultural and economic achievements over the ages would want to be preeminent in its neighborhood. I don't find anything strange about that. The only question is, really, how does that happen? And you can, one can see it, one trying to have achieve that via a kind of big guy in the playground kind of way, or a softer way where, China sort of relies much more on soft power and on established international law and turning the other cheek and de-emotionalizing some of its nationalist rhetoric and appealing to other people that they can truly indeed relax around China more and don't need the Americans so much because China is a different kind of country now.
Right. And as George pointed out, China has spent a huge amount of money, more than $1 trillion on infrastructure, foreign aid, basically, you know? I mean, one could argue that it's just getting rid of surplus steel, you know, in these things, but it is doing It is doing good work in Southeast Asia and in other parts in Central Asia.
I totally agree about.
But what I'd like to know is, you were doing that for about 20 years or 15 years, and now under the current administration, soft power seems to be de-emphasized, and hard power, particularly now we're talking about the South. I'm talking about the South China Sea. Has taken over.
Yeah.
What happened? What's happening?
Well, first, I beg to differ. First of all, the soft power you mentioned, they are expanding with the One Belt, One Road initiative. They're going around the world trying to help everybody build up their infrastructure. Now, as far as the soft power in South China Sea is concerned, I totally agree and support Professor French's comment. Okay. The only difference is, how do you exercise your soft power and influence all the time the U.S. aircraft carriers in their exercise of freedom of navigation, FON, is sailing up and down the South China Sea to let the Chinese know that, hey, we're here and we're exercising our right. Put it the other way. What if the Chinese were sailing up and down the Gulf of Mexico exercising their freedom of navigation and having their surveillance planes flying around the east coast of the United States? Now, how would the United States accept that kind of a arrangement, should we say? Now, that's truly would be a quid pro quo in the exercise of soft power.
I'd like to respond, since Please. You framed that in a question. So we have a recent example just a few weeks ago. I live in New York City. This was in the national news, but slightly more was made of it in the local news, that Russian warships showed up off of Long Island, patrolling off of Long Island with heavy-duty, intelligence-collecting operations taking place, and you're going up and down the East Coast right off the shore of the United States. Did we threaten the Russians? Did we say the Russians were threatening us? Did we lodge a diplomatic protest? Did we send the Navy out to, chase them away? We did none of those things. And the reason we did none of those things is because this kind of behavior is actually sanctioned by conventions of maritime usage. And there are zones that are called exclusive economic zone, which is 200 miles. Mm-hmm. And then there is a 20-mile limit, which is simply an exclusive zone, that you can't enter the 20-mile limit without permission, but the 200-mile limit permission zone, you can do all sorts of things, including most countries understand. China is one of a very small number of countries that don't interpret this way, that you can send your military ships inside of the 200-mile zone as long as they're not operating in any hostile way or conducting maneuvers or doing a variety of other things that are very well spelled out. So that's point one. Point two is China has done, and I detail this in my book, I don't want to emphasize China being a kind of troublemaker. The question was, what would the United States think if fill in the blank? And so I have to fill in the blank. So China sent ships, unannounced, to monitor naval maneuvers off of Hawaii within the last few years. Surfaced,
a submarine
undetected to say, hey, we're here to do this, right? Very provocative from your perspective if you take this standard, right? China circumnavigated Japan in the very same way, detailed in my book, inside the economic zone of the Japanese, circumnavigated all of Japan inside of the 200-mile zone. So you have to choose which position you want. Do you want the position that this is bad behavior that should be condemned or ruled out, or that we have to get all countries to say 200-mile limit is a 200-mile limit and it's sacrosanct? Or do you want to have it as a situational thing where, it's bad when other people do it because it aggravates China and you should never aggravate China, or what?
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned the submarine incident, because I noticed it was a footnote on your last chapter, and it has to do with a 2006 incident when the Kitty Hawk, the flotilla, was exercising in Pacific. As you know, when the aircraft carrier sails in the ocean, it's surrounded by all kinds of ships because the aircraft carrier is like a sitting duck. They have to be protected with with other battleships, destroyers, so on. And in this particular incident that Professor French pointed out, lo and behold, right in the middle of this, a Chinese submarine popped up in the middle and sort of say hello to everybody and then disappeared again. Now, to me, that is a wonderful exercise of soft power. Because it's absolutely saying that we have a viable second strike. Be careful.
But okay. I mean, I think that if an American submarine popped up near the Chinese aircraft carrier, China's sole aircraft carrier,
yeah,
the reaction would be fierce. And they wouldn't consider it soft power. But however, okay, in China we have a man who says that he wants to make China great again, and lo and behold, in the United States we have a man who says he wants to make America great again. What are your thoughts right now with the current Trump administration? Do you think that things are going to get a lot worse because of the man, the promises he's made during the campaign? And just his unpredictability.
I think you've said it already. Trump is a kind of total wild card. I don't have much original to say about this. I'm kind of just still dumbfounded every time I see him speak. And every day brings, and I don't say this because one should not infer from this an ideological opposition to Trump. I don't have an ideological sympathy with the kind of people he formed a cabinet with, but the dumbfoundedness comes from something much more essential than ideology.
Twitter.
Well, it comes across via Twitter, right? Yeah. This is a person who clearly doesn't have preparation for the job, who does not have a history of consistent positions that are well thought through, that he has aerated with in debate and contact with other really knowledgeable and experienced people. He has a kind of an infantile picture of things. He seems like his worldview stopped developing in the 1980s. I could just go on and on. I don't know where this is going to go, either for the United States specifically or with regard to relations with China. I have a hard time imagining that this is going to end well, but I don't know.
I mean, in other words, it always takes two to tango, right?
Right.
Trump can say all sorts of things. It really depends on how the Chinese Xi Jinping react to this.
I'm actually being very helpful here. I wrote a piece, to make America great again, Trump will have to work with China. Because where is he going to get the money and the skills to build up the infrastructure that he promised? And we all know the United States sadly needs an infrastructure rebuilt. But guess what? The Chinese are already doing it. China Construction America, CCA, based in New Jersey, bid and won a $400 million contract to refurbish the Alexander Hamilton Bridge. Now, you must know what that bridge is, right? That's the George Washington Bridge, extended over the East River. And they won the contract, they did it, and my friends who's gone by did not see a single Chinese worker. These are all American workers just being managed and supervised by CCA. There's a CRRC, which is a rail car building company. They won a contract to resupply the subway cars in Chicago, and they're building a plant in Chicago to make those cars. This is what the Chinese typically call win-win arrangements. There's a auto glass company investing in Ohio. They're building 4 million windshields for cars and 4 million replacements. They will hire 3,000 workers. They will inject $20 to $30 million every month into the Ohio economy, and I venture to guess the governor of Ohio is not complaining.
Well, I have to. Yeah. I have to. I don't want to come across as the kind of naysayer or prophet of doom, right? But I think if you are a serious student of history, you have to, let's take the United States and China out of the conversation for the moment. You very quickly come to the conclusion that economic integration between countries has very rarely served as a sufficient buffer as to be able to prevent war when other serious differences about basic national interests come to the fore. I think we can go back to Greece, or I can go actually Assyria if you like. I mean, you can go as far back as you want. I think in era after era that's been the case, and I don't mean to say this because it means the United States and China are predestined to have a war. I don't want war. I don't think any of us want war. It would be senseless to want war. But I think that finding a modus vivendi between these two countries is something that goes well beyond economic matters. It goes to kind of dispositions toward international order that have barely begun to be worked out and that need to have a much more frank, open, sustained, and matured conversation between the two countries and with other concerned countries.
I can take the opportunity here just to say to our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are discussing relations between China and the United States. Our guests are Howard French, the former New York Times Asia correspondent, and Dr. George Ku, a regular contributor to the online Asia Times. I'm George Lewinsky, your moderator. You can hear the Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, catch up with program videos on the club's YouTube channel, and visit us on Facebook and Twitter. One thing that I guess makes both Beijing and Washington nervous is North Korea. Secretary Tillerson has been in Asia. They had discussions. It's not clear what the discussions were about, except publicly, Secretary Tillerson sounded quite mild about China compared to his boss, his tweets in Washington. How do you feel that Asia trip went for Tillerson?
So again, it's really hard to know what Trump is all about. Part of this could be the sort of classic good cop, bad cop. So Trump, even in the midst of the Tillerson trip, is tweeting in a very provocative way. Tillerson goes there and he surprises the Chinese by being a man of, reasonable civilization. Like, what's the standard?
Right.
And this, so everybody feels good. So that's one thing. The other thing I would say is that Tillerson was the head, as you all know, of the world's most successful oil company and one of its most successful companies, period, and a company with an extraordinary culture of secrecy of its own. And, so that's who Tillerson is. And one possible scenario is that Tillerson, because of that, because of his background, is the kind of guy who you're never going to get a readout of what's really happening behind the closed doors. Add to that he didn't bring the professional press corps with him. It could also be because, as some people say, Tillerson's just simply got no swack in the Trump administration, or that he's a cipher, or that he's just not up to the... We really don't... So this whole Trump thing is just so new and incongruous right now that it's very hard to say.
Hey, I need to interject here about North Korea. If you read Bill Perry's memoir, the former Secretary of Defense, it was never China's problem. North Korea was always a United States problem because North Korea only feared for their security on what the Americans would do to them. They know that China will never put them under or force them out of the regime. So when China organized the six-party talks, during the George W. Bush's year, all of a sudden everybody said, hey, this is a Chinese problem. They're the ones that need to solve it because they're the only ones that can keep North Korea alive. But North Korea knows China is not going to let them implode because the only part that they're worrying about and the only reason they developed the nuclear weapon was as a bargaining chip with the United States. And they all, Bill Perry almost did it, except the Clinton administration ran out of time, and George W. for 3 years ignored the North Korea problem until North Korea developed the bomb, because they didn't have it before. Read Bill Perry's memoir. It's all there. I didn't make any of this up. No alternative news here.
I'm afraid we've come to the end, and our thanks to Howard French, former New York Times Asia correspondent and the author of the new book, Everything Under the Heavens, How the Past Helps China's Push for Global Power, and Dr. George Koo, regular contributor to the online Asia Times and chairman of the Burlingame Global Foundation. We also thank everyone here, as well as our audience on radio, television, and the Internet. Tonight's program has been co-organized by the Committee of 100. We also remind everyone here that copies of Howard French's book are on sale, and he'll be pleased to sign copies following this program. I'm George Lewinsky, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in, is adjourned.